Dr. Katz is a renowned expert in nutrition, weight control, and preventing chronic diseases. Dr. Katz got his BA from Dartmouth, his PhD from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and his MPH from Yale University. He is currently the director of the Yale University Research Prevention Center. So let's give a great big Juice Plus welcome to Dr. David Katz.
If you get a standing ovation just for walking out on stage, it just totally takes away your motivation. It's very, very kind of you, but I could only go downhill from here. Thank you. And of course, my day, there's no hope for the rest of my day. I just had the highlight of my day. Thank you for that. It's great to be with you. It's great to be part of this network. I am proud to have you be part of the network of effort to turn the tide of chronic disease, obesity, diabetes, affecting adults and children alike. I am proud to be part of your network. And I thank you for the support that you show in this effort to see these trends reversed sooner rather than later. So I'm really proud and delighted to be here, and I thank you. We're going to talk about the crisis you've heard mentioned by several speakers already today, but on the upside, we're also going to talk primarily about what we can do to address the alarm bell that is sounding with regard to the dietary patterns and physical activity patterns in this country. So what is it that we need to know about calories, crises, and particular clues to get our health back on track? I won't belabor the statistics that you've already heard from several prior speakers, but we must acknowledge, as our nation wrestles with an economic crisis, as we deal with crises related to military engagements, that we do indeed face a bona fide crisis in public health of the first order. It is a clear and present danger. It stalks all of us in our homes. It stalks the homes of our friends and family. It is at the heels of our children and theirs. And it has to do with the adverse effects of dietary patterns at odds with prevailing recommendations, lack of physical activity, and of course an array of other related behaviors. But these in particular. And as a consequence of eating at odds with what we know to be best for human health, as a consequence of being too sedentary, we do indeed have epidemic obesity among adults. As many as 80% of adults in the United States are overweight. And there was recently a projection in the scientific literature that by approximately 2050, should current trends persist, overweight will be universal among adults in the United States and increasingly much of the world. As a result of epidemic obesity and overweight, we have epidemic insulin resistance. This state is antecedent to diabetes. We have epidemic type 2 diabetes in adults. And the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel, which offers guidance to, and forgive me for correcting Linda, I'm an MD, not a PhD, so to doctors such as me in our care of patients, the guidance they offer tells us if your patient has diabetes, assume heart disease and treat accordingly. The link between the two is that strong. And thus, after decades of decline in cardiovascular disease in this country, we stand on the brink of seeing that trend reverse, a rise in heart disease risk factors, a rise in cardiovascular morbidity, and potentially even a rise in cardiovascular mortality. And this could potentially be an adequate characterization of the crisis that we face. But as you just heard Linda emphasize children, I think that's appropriate here too. Now, of course, you are an army committed to good works, and I might speak to you in a professional capacity as a fellow crusader for better health. But we are, first and foremost, members of the human family. We're people. The greatest calling here comes not necessarily from what we do as professionals, but with the simple, profound bonds of common humanity that bind us in love to other people. If I may ask by a show of hands, how many of you are parents? A lot of hands in the air. Grandparents? Aunts or uncles? Know a kid? I don't want to leave anybody out. At this point, the only person I've left out is someone who's too damn lazy to put their hands in the air. And I know that wouldn't be found in this particular audience. We are a nation of families. We are a nation of adults concerned with the well-being of children. We are a nation of parents and grandparents, aunts and uncles. So it really is by recognizing how this crisis stalks our children that we inspire the greatest passion. What often we are unwilling to do for ourselves, we are invariably willing to do for our children. And yes, indeed, we have epidemic obesity in our children. I believe it was Linda, if not one of the prior speakers, who mentioned that officially the CDC would have us believe that roughly 16% to 20% of children and adolescents nationwide are overweight or obese. Does anybody believe that statistic? Higher, right? Right? I mean, you can do the eyeball test. You don't need the National Center for Health Statistics. Just walk around a shopping mall and look around, right? Or go to your local school. That's what I do. I have 5 children. I met Bill Sears backstage. He has 8 children. I rarely have the pleasure of meeting somebody stupider than I am with regard to having children, so that was a great privilege this morning. But I have 5 children. 2 are now in college, 2 are in middle school, and 1 remains in the elementary school they've all attended over the years, and to which I dutifully go each year to see the annual talent show, God Help Me. Now, the definition of talent in this elementary school is a very suspect thing, with the exception of my children, of course. But what is not is the preponderance of flesh on display, because the kids are up on stage in tights and leotards, and there ain't no way just 1 in 5 of these kids is overweight. It's easily half, maybe 2 out of 3. It gets worse every year. And this is a fairly well-to-do Connecticut suburb. It's got to be worse just about everywhere else. Personally, I believe that 50% or more of our children nationwide are already overweight. And one of the reasons we don't see that in the statistics is that the definition of overweight in children traditionally has been very exclusive. The age and sex adjusted body mass index at or above the 95th percentile. And the reason for that is the stigma of obesity. We are loath to pin this stigmatizing label to a child. And so we have defined it in such a way where we leave many overweight children out rather than risk putting a non-overweight child in the group. We can fix that, by the way, by eliminating this problem. Obesity is the last bastion of socially acceptable prejudice in our society. That must stop. Obesity is not the fault of the individual. It is not by individual choice that we live at the one point in history when obesity is the norm. It never has been before, and I'll characterize that further. If we can fight obesity without fighting the victims of this epidemic, we can more accurately characterize it when and where we see it. In my view, 50% of our children are overweight. We have epidemic insulin resistance in children as a result. We do indeed have epidemic type 2 diabetes in kids. Now again, this thunder has to some degree been stolen by previous speakers who admonished you on this topic as well. So you may now be somewhat immune to its shock value. But let us make no mistake, the occurrence of type 2 diabetes in children at all, let alone at epidemic levels, is a shock and awe proposition. And it is lamentable that it fails to induce shock or awe. When I went to medical school, I learned about 2 kinds of diabetes, juvenile onset and adult onset. I was actually recognized this year by the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation in Connecticut. I received their annual award. And when I thank you. You really are a very, very kind audience. Thank you. That was not a boast. That was to lead into what I said when I went up to the microphone on that occasion. I said, I am in equal measure honored and horrified by this recognition because I don't do juvenile diabetes. Juvenile diabetes is type 1. It's an autoimmune disease. I work to fight the trends in obesity and poor diet and lack of physical activity. I'm not a type 1 diabetes researcher. The very fact that you recognize me, you, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, tells us how very badly things have gone awry. Because, in fact, the disease that I combat is adult-onset diabetes occurring in children. It is my personal preference, in fact, that we would abandon the euphemism type 2 diabetes and call it like it is. When this disease occurs in a child under the age of 10, we nonetheless call it adult-onset diabetes and remind ourselves each and every time that this should never occur. But alas, it does. And should we remain on this trajectory, things will get even worse. I said the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel offers guidance to clinicians and tells us to treat diabetes as we would treat heart disease. There is no pediatric treatment panel for this group. We are unaccustomed to thinking of ischemic heart disease as a pediatric condition. But children have blood vessels. Children, too, succumb to diabetes in just the way that adults do. If a 7- and 8-year-old can develop adult-onset diabetes, by the time they are 17 and 18, they will indeed be vulnerable to angina pectoris and myocardial infarction. Heart disease will take its place alongside acne as an adolescent rite of passage should we remain on our current trajectory. And I do know personally of a 17-year-old boy who's had a triple coronary bypass. Now, I hope you all just heard that. That gasp is a good thing. I frequently lecture to professional audiences. And when I address, for example, medical students, and I talk about type 2 diabetes in children, they do not gasp, as you did not gasp. When I talk about the evolution of this trend, the inescapable evolution of this trend to heart disease in adolescence, and provide, unfortunately, a real-world example of it, they gasp as you gasped. But the history with regard to type 2 diabetes tells us we can get used to anything. And I fear the day when my successor is on stage at the podium lecturing to medical students a generation from now about the epidemiology of heart disease in adolescence and no one gasps. Please keep that gasp in mind. It is right, it is correct, and we must act to make sure that this particular prediction never comes true. Okay. Please forgive me for a rather lugubrious start to this discussion. Let's have a little fun now. And in particular, as we move towards solutions to this problem, because a crisis is a dangerous opportunity. Yes, admittedly, there is danger in this crisis. But it is always darkest just before the dawn. It is the danger that cultivates in us the will to seize opportunity and, if need be, create it, will it into existence. But before we can devise solutions, we really need to understand the origins of this problem. And since ultimately obesity as the root cause of diabetes, heart disease, on the causal pathway to cancer, is an outcome of behaviors we control. What we do each day with our feet and our forks, right? I'm in charge of mine, you're in charge of yours. The question must be this: why would a putatively intelligent species do this to itself? Why would we, in essence, eat ourselves to death and encourage our children to do the same? Now, there are many potential answers you could call out here. And I've been in smaller audiences where we make this interactive, and I get a very long list, and you may be thinking of some of those. So I will say, without going through that exercise, whatever answer you would call out now is probably correct. But were we to put them all together into a single package, the answer to this question is this. We eat ourselves to death because we can. Throughout the history of Homo sapiens, and for that matter, every omnivorous species on the planet, eating palatable food when it was available has always made sense before. Calories have been a rate-limiting commodity in our struggle to survive. We have always lived, in other words, in a world where calories were relatively scarce and hard to get. I submit to you that as a species, we have no native defenses against caloric excess, never having needed them before. Nor have we any native defenses against the lure of the couch. Animals in nature run after stuff they want to eat and away from stuff that wants to eat them. That's about it. There is not a lot of superfluous energy expenditure. It makes no sense if you're unsure when your next calories are coming along. Fundamentally, having always lived in a world where calories were scarce and hard to get and physical activity unavoidable, we now find ourselves in a world where physical activity is scarce and hard to get and calories are unavoidable. We have no native defenses against this particular mess. the polar bear in the Sahara has been my figurative trademark for a decade and a half, long before global warming made this an actual concern. But my meaning is different. It's not that polar bears are endangered, which indeed they are, but rather that they highlight to us that we are endangered, because we too are creatures out of place. Polar bears are magnificently adapted to a particular environment. All of the traits that make a polar bear uniquely a polar bear are well suited to the cold, and specifically well suited to soak up and retain what is in a cold environment a scarce commodity, warmth. So polar bears have a double-layered coat. The inner layer insulates, minimizing dissipation of heat out from the body of the bear. The outer layer is comprised of hollow hairs, conduits which direct solar radiation to the skin of the bear. The skin of the polar bear under the white coat is black to best absorb all wavelengths of light. Despite their large size, polar bears actually have a minimal surface area. They're aerodynamic in design, particularly a small head as compared to, say, a grizzly bear. Again, reducing the confrontation with wind and heat dissipation. But everything that allows you to soak up and retain warmth that is advantageous in the cold conspires against you in the heat. Were polar bears to find themselves beneath the burning sun of the Sahara in summer, all of the very traits that make them flourish now would cook their goose. And the point, of course, is this. We are creatures, too. We can be arrogant creatures and overlook our indelible links with the world we live in, the planet we live on. It is unwise to do so. We too are hardwired to survive in a world we have always known. People overeating in a land of golden arches are more alike than they may seem to polar bears overheating beneath the Sahara sun. Here at last is the good news. I fibbed a bit when I said we have no native defenses against caloric excess and the lore of the couch. We do indeed have one. Great big Homo sapien brains. We are smarter than the average bear. If we understand the nature of this problem, we have the capacity to outthink it. And that's exactly what we must do. So as we begin to explore how we fix this problem, the primary resource at our disposal is human ingenuity, human resourcefulness, and our collective intelligence. And frankly, I think that's up to any challenge. However, there is a danger in having a great big Homo sapien brain. And that is we can overthink things. I think we overthink the obesity epidemic. I have many colleagues who study the physiological minutiae to explain epidemic obesity. I have very respected colleagues who make careers looking at the contents of chromatographs and peering through the lenses of microscopes. They are right to point out that there are many genes involved in energy regulation. They are correct to note that at least 50 genes have been implicated in energy balance. At least 200 are under active investigation. They were correct to point out the importance of leptin. They were correct to note the significance of ghrelin, a hormone produced by the stomach that triggers appetite and the reason why bariatric surgery is more effective than one would anticipate from the mere effects of cold hard steel. The procedure actually reduces hormone levels in the blood. They are right to point out the physiological underpinnings of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. And yet, there is a grave risk of missing the forest for the trees, because which hormone, which gene, which neurochemical in human physiology has changed appreciably in the last 10, 50, 500, 5,000, 15,000, and I could keep going, years? And the answer, of course, is none. Human physiology is much the same as it ever was. Certainly, we have seen no major change in human physiology in the last half century, during which we have seen the advent of epidemic obesity. It is the world around us that is the same as it never was before. We must look past the trees and see the simplicity of this forest. We are vulnerable to obesity and all of the related chronic diseases because of too many calories in and too few calories out. Period. End of story. Thanks for having me. Time to go. That's it. The U.S. produces 3,900 calories a day for every man, woman, and child in the country after export. Now, unless you ride routinely with Lance or do something comparable or swim with Michael, you don't need 3,900 calories a day. But since we produce those calories, there is an incentive to peddle them to us. So we have an excess supply, and Madison Avenue makes hay with that, of course. And alas, so do mothers. They can't help themselves. Ladies, forgive me. There's always a danger in going this direction, and I realize you may storm the stage, but I'm going to take my chances. Because I want to make the point that while our genes underlie this problem, our genes are what they are, and they are what they have always been. Our culture also underlies this problem, and our culture is a medium of our own devising, vulnerable to our will, susceptible to change as required to meet our current needs. Our culture tells us, for instance, that plate cleaning is a good thing. Now, in these particular economic times, it may take on increased significance again. But speaking about the way things were last month, plate cleaning is a dubious practice. Now, I recall when I was a child, I would finish my dinner, push back from the table, and my mother would say, "David, finish your dinner." And I would say, "Mom, I've had enough." And she would say, "David, you clean your plate now." And I'd say, "But Mom, I'm full." And she would say, "David, there are starving kids in China." And I would say, "Mom, I'm just not totally clear on how me getting fat's going to help them any. Maybe you could make a care package and send it on over there." And she would say, "Don't talk back to me, young man." So I dutifully became a plump kid, which I subsequently had to fix. And it is worth noting that since the time of these exchanges, we have witnessed the dawn of epidemic obesity in China as well. I'm not sure if my mother is causally implicated. But my point is this. Plate cleaning actually did make sense when my mother was growing up. It's what her mother told her. It's what her mother told her. But these were women, these were mothers who went through world wars and Great Depression. They knew want. As throughout most of history, there was the fear that tomorrow that plate might not be filled, and therefore waste not a scrap today. In an age of epidemic childhood obesity, admonishing children to empty oversized and overfilled plates makes not a whit of sense. We should give kids smaller portions on smaller plates. They can ask for more if they want it, and if they have the good sense to stop eating when full, pat them on the back and emulate their good example. Two more examples of cultural anachronism. I recently, this week I think, did an interview with ABC News. They're talking about some of the bargains that are emerging in this time of economic downturn, including mega-sized meals where if you eat, for example, 76 ounces, I think it was, of steak, you get the meal for free. God help us. Well, you know, we have always revered a bargain. We're Americans, damn it. And no blue-blooded American can resist the bargain of an all-you-can-eat buffet, right? More food, no extra charge. So as some of you may have heard from me before, part of my mission is to travel the highways and byways of this very sensible country, reach out, grab people by the lapels of common sense, and say, "Listen to me. You are going to get fat at no extra charge and then spend a fortune to lose the weight that you gained for free. Wake up and smell the Slim Fast." And then one more. I'll be talking about schools momentarily. I've been going into schools for a long time, railing against these threats, admonishing school officials to do something about this, to get involved, to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And eventually I drive them quite mad. And when they've gone quite mad, they turn to one another and whisper and say, "We have to do something to get rid of this guy. So tell him yes." So they turn to me and say, "Okay, Dr. Katz, we've heard you. We understand that these threats, that we take them very seriously. We care about kids too. We are going to do something to combat childhood obesity. We are going to raise money to combat childhood obesity. We'll hold a bake sale." In theory, at least, culture is a medium of our own devising, and when it's this silly, we can change it. And indeed we should. By the way, I think, I've never seen anybody do this, but I've long had the notion that classrooms might adopt a neighborhood, And on a particular occasion, maybe even on a weekend, the teacher would lead the whole class and they would clean up the neighborhood. They would gather up litter and they would collect donations at each of the houses as they go. They'd get physical activity, they would provide a public service, and they could do their fundraising that way. And nobody would have to eat cookies laden with trans fat to get there. And we are couch potatoes, too many calories out. It has been suggested that perhaps we are lazy. It has been suggested perhaps we lack willpower or self-discipline. We have not a shred of evidence to suggest that we lack willpower our ancestors had. We have very considerable evidence that our ancestors lack the technological devices that we have. And so we take advantage of the technology available to us. Leaf blowers, snow blowers, blackberries, you name it. And with each new wave of technological advance, there is a decrement in daily energy expenditure. It simply was the case before that people didn't need to go out of their way to exercise. They did their physical work, and it was called work or survival. We now have to put in a full day of work, at the end of which, when we're tired, or before which, at the crack of dawn, we have to carve out time for exercise. It is an additional burden. And you need specialized equipment to do it, right? You can't just work. You need elliptical machines. I have an elliptical machine. You need specialized footwear. We take an annual vacation to Cape Cod each summer, and my brother-in-law, both of us very physically active, my dad's in on this as well, but my brother-in-law, we have an Imelda Marcos competition each year because we've got specialized footwear for every activity we do. I think he won last summer, but I'm looking forward to the rematch. So there is a great deal of complexity here, but also it's very simple. If we ate better and were more physically active, we could solve this. And the notion that learning about our genes will ever solve the problem is misguided. Just imagine if your mission were to identify the genes responsible for making polar bears overheat in the Sahara Desert. They are the very genes that make polar bears polar bears. And in fact, I've often suggested that one of the best ways to think of obesity, rather than as anything gone amiss with the body, is like drowning. We don't wonder what's gone wrong with a body if someone drowns when underwater too long. We know that our bodies, unlike the bodies of fish, are maladapted to spend a long time underwater. Well, we're spending a long time in a sea of calories, and we're drowning in them. It is not our bodies that are misbehaving. It is the way we treat them. That is what must be fixed. So, I am a scientist. I make my living doing clinical trials. That's my day job, running Yale's Prevention Research Center. But if my foot were to catch on fire, I would not need a randomized clinical trial to fetch a pail of water. And frankly, what we need to do here is about as simple as that. Everything at our disposal to help people eat better and be more active is part of the solution. And were we to effectively implement this solution, we should be clear on what the gains would be. Applying what we already know about a short list of behaviors, tobacco use, physical activity, and dietary pattern, we could reduce heart disease rates by 80%, cancer by 60% or more, diabetes by 90% or more, and similar benefits across an array of other conditions. Any small portion of any one of these would be worth a Nobel Prize. It is knowledge we already have. Knowledge is only power if we use it as such. We are currently squandering this power and this potential, which is one of the reasons it's so gratifying to be in front of an audience of this size, knowing that you are committed to the conversion of this knowledge into power that can make a positive difference in the world. But you should be inspired by the magnitude of positive difference we can make. Getting there, however, will not be easy. We know what a healthful diet could do, but this is the world we live in. How do we get there from here? Well, one thing we should not do is think that any single intervention is the solution. Now, if I thought I was going to stir you up talking about mothers, I risk doing it even more gravely by talking about Juice Plus, a wonderful product. But let us be clear, and I suspect you know this, this wonderful product is not by itself the solution to these crises. And one way to think of it, or any other single thing we might do, is as a sandbag in a levee. We face a flood tide. of factors contributing to obesity and chronic disease. What does it take to contain the waters of a flood? Well, if we do one thing, let's say it's the provision of Juice Plus, but more germane to my talk today, let's say we take soda out of schools and then ask the question, did this reverse the health trends in the children? Are they now suddenly all lean? What we would find is, no, that didn't work. We have failed to contain the flood. If we then abandon that, if we allow, for example, the soda companies to point to that science and say, you have tested this hypothesis, and you have shown that soda in school is not the problem, therefore leave it alone. We say, okay, we'll leave that alone, we'll try something else. We'll do a worksite intervention. We'll offer physical activity breaks at the worksite. Will we then reverse the trends that we are seeing? And the answer is, again, we will not. But folks, this is like looking for the culpable snowflakes in a lethal avalanche. Examined one by one, there is no culpable snowflake. They're all exonerated. And by the time you're done, the entire mass of snow that has killed a group of people is innocent of the deed. And the answer, of course, is only collectively are they indeed guilty of the deed. And only by preventing the entire avalanche can you save those lives. Similarly here, it is not that soda in school is irrelevant. It is not that worksite wellness is irrelevant. It is not that a supplement like Juice Plus is irrelevant, but rather we must do these and everything else we possibly can all together, stack one atop the other, and build a barrier that is commensurate to the threat we face. When the levee rises above the floodwaters will recede, and I believe fervently we can, in fact, turn this tide. What are some of the specific strategies we need to adopt? Well, I mentioned earlier, obesity is not the fault of the individual. How can I make that case? I make that case because we have historically called upon willpower. We have gone so far as to say, if there's a will, there is a way. You know what, folks? It's wrong. If there is a will, there may very well be a commitment to finding a way if there is one. But what if there is no way? What if you have a will and your way is blocked? That is a formula for frustration at best, desperation at worst. So I would like to modify this popular adage as follows. Now, I trust this is a highly cultured audience and that everybody's seen the Spider-Man movies. Spider-Man 1? Spider-Man 2? Excellent, right? Spider-Man 3 was a little disappointing. Well, in any event, I digress. In the Spider-Man movies, Peter Parker's Uncle Ben says, Peter, with great power comes great responsibility. There is a public health corollary to that, in my view. Before we ask people to take responsibility, and indeed we can, indeed we should, and perhaps we must make sure they are empowered to do so. Providing people no options to be physically active in a hostile environment, or no access to healthful foods, and then admonishing them to be physically active and eat well is a formula for frustration. We must couple empowerment, modification of the environment, create the opportunity so that there is, for will, a corresponding way. Will and way coupled are a force for good. Will divorced of way or way divorced of will is a formula for nothing but perpetuation of the status quo. What are some of the skills we might impart? What are the tools and resources we could deliver? This is my life's work, and I'll give you just a few examples. One, addressing the doctor-patient interaction, is called ouch, this won't hurt a bit. That's directed toward the physician because I wanted to flip things around. Ouch stands for online weight management counseling for the healthcare provider. We've actually done a decade of research in behavior modification and converted what we have learned and done into an online training program for healthcare providers to make them better at providing constructive and compassionate counseling to their patients. You can visit this now and see the current mock-up of this at ouch.info. And we must be creative about addressing some of the impasses we encounter. There were earlier comments about the healthcare system at large. We have substantially a reimbursement-based healthcare system. Things that are paid for get done. Things that are not paid for don't get done. On the other hand, things that work get paid for. You can have an impasse that makes no sense. Docs don't counsel because they're not reimbursed to do it. There is no reimbursement because we don't think docs know how to counsel. We must fix the two simultaneously. What we're currently working to do in Connecticut is a pilot study where we say we will put physicians through this training program. Their name will drop into a database. The database will be accessible to insurers. Insurers will then have insurance that these docs know what they're doing when they counsel. We would ask that they reimburse those docs who've been trained to counsel well for a time-limited period, and then let's do a cost-benefit analysis and see if everybody can win. I've gone into schools, as I said, for a long time, and I have said, look, you know, this trend toward the elimination of phys ed and recess is unacceptable. Kids need physical activity. And they have said, in response to that, no child left behind. We must focus on standardized tests, or we lose a financial benefit that is our lifeline. We don't have time for recess. We don't have time for phys ed. Here again was another of those impasses, the square peg, round hole scenario. Never let that discourage you. Recognize that human resourcefulness is always up to the task of whittling the peg or drilling a new hole. It just requires the right tools to get that job done. And in this case, the right tools were handed to me by my then 5-year-old son. And at the risk of some of you having heard this anecdote before, I'll tell it briefly now. Gabe is now 9, so this was 4 years ago. He was 5 and a half. I was speaking at Dartmouth in a very large auditorium with stairs on either side. And it was in the evening, and families constituted the audience. So my wife, Catherine, was in the front row. My 4 daughters were lined up next to her on one side, being little angels. And then there was Gabe, who at 7 o'clock in the evening had things he would rather be doing than listen to his dad pontificate. So he started showing his displeasure, and then he really started showing. So I'm talking, and Catherine's saying, Gabriel, sit in your chair. Gabriel, you're kicking me, and your elbow's in my ear. And he doesn't have Tourette's, by the way, just a normal 5-year-old kid, but fidgety and squirmy and, you know, really just totally out of, and it just got out of control. And I said, folks, I'm watching my wife out of the corner of my eye. My son is torturing her. Excuse me for just a minute, please. Gabriel, get up, for crying out loud. You're torturing your mother. You're distracting me. Here's what I want you to do. If you can't sit still, I want you to run along this hall, go up the stairs, out the door, along the corridor, in the other door, down the stairs, come back to your seat, and sit still so your mom can listen to me. I'm saying very important stuff. Gabe gave me a look as if to say, do you mean it, Dad? Are you crazy? I said, yeah, I mean it. Go. He shrugged his shoulders and took off. I kept talking. Gabe came around at the end of his lap, sat down next to his mother, gave me an impish, in-your-face, Dad, you asked for it kind of look, and took off again. I shrugged my shoulders and kept talking. Gabe came around at the end of lap 2, never bothered to sit down, just waved and kept right on going, and 3 kids got up and followed him. This is exactly how it happened. I mean, it would be a great story even if I were making it up. It's exactly how it happened. When the 4 of them came around, nobody sat down. They all kept going. Every kid in the audience under the age of 12 got up and took off after them. We have 35 kids running laps now. So, you know, for a minute I thought, well, you know, there goes the talk. I mean, my audience is thinking, the poor guy, you know, this is terrible. I'm thinking my audience is going to need scopolamine patches to prevent motion sickness. And then it dawned on me. And I said, you know, folks, this is more important than anything I could have said here this evening. Because I assume your kids are healthy. My son is healthy. I mean, Lord knows if you're cooped up with him for any length of time, you need to medicate either him or yourself. But he's healthy. They are rambunctious. And rambunctious in children needs to be treated with something more like recess and less like Ritalin. Thank you. ABC for Fitness was born. It stands for Activity Bursts in the Classroom. It is a program that we have developed with phys ed experts, education experts, costs the school nothing, increases teaching time, and provides at least 30 minutes of physical activity each day. We're finishing up a 3-year controlled evaluation of this in 13 elementary schools in the Midwest. Our evaluation includes fitness, obviously, performance on academic standardized tests, because the literature shows physically active kids perform better, behavioral disruptions in the classroom, which are declining, and yes, indeed, we are tracking Ritalin use. This program is on my website. It is free and available to all. Please spread the word. And now the pièce de résistance, the real reason I'm here and the real reason that I began my talk with a heartfelt thank you, because Juice Plus and NSA have been involved in supporting nutrition detectives from the beginning and now have helped us trade up to create an interactive DVD. Nutrition Detectives is the nutrition analog to ABC for Fitness. It is a brief, targeted nutrition education program, principally for elementary schools, that basically teaches children the practical skills they need to identify and choose more nutritious food. I did begin the talk on a lugubrious note with you. That's not necessary with children. You need to talk to children about what they like to do, basketball, swimming, soccer, dance, whatever it may be, and you then ask them where they get the energy to do it, and they know it's from food. And you get them to understand that eating well produces more energy to do stuff that they love to do. The bottom line for kids, and this resonates with 8, 9, and 10-year-olds, is that healthy people have more fun. Kids are expert in fun. So this program focuses on that, and it is courtesy, along with my lab and the support of NSA, the input of my colleagues shown here, my wife Catherine and my kids, all of whom have been involved in helping to develop this. And what we do is we teach kids to see past deception and get to the truth. So, for example, what should you look for if you're choosing a fruit juice? Well, on the cover there might be pictures of fruit, and that would make you think the juice is made out of fruit. And you should ask the question, is it in fact made out of fruit? This one is. Here we have another fruit punch sold in supermarkets, lots of fruit on the front of the package. That would make you think it's made out of fruit. You should ask the question, is it made out of fruit? Turns out, no, it's made out of artificial flavors, colors, sugars, and chemicals. In fact, Gabriel would like to know, where exactly are the fruits in this particular fruit drink? There are none. And the average 8-year-old recognizes this is an unacceptable deception when sensitized to it, and they are prepared to defend themselves against this. But they need the skill power to do it. We teach them the anatomy of a food package, where to look for the truth. The front of the box, of course, is an advertisement. That's the fantasy Madison Avenue wants you to accept. The only place you'll get the truth and nothing but the truth is the ingredient list and the nutrition facts panel. So we tell people that's where you need to look. And this information, by the way, is intended for parents as well as children. We just use the children to deliver the information to the entire household and help convert them to healthy eating. And very often what's on the back where the truth resides is very much at odds with what is on the front. And we teach them how to make that distinction. So it's the nutrition facts and the ingredient list that provide the unadulterated truth. We send the nutrition detectives there. Nutrition writer Michael Pollan. Have some of you heard of Michael Pollan? Makes a very prudent statement when he says, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. But like so much good advice, it's very hard to follow, because 95% of the food choices available to us come in bags, boxes, bottles, jars, and cans, and who can tell if they're plants or mostly plants? It's very hard to know where these foods came from because the link to nature has been cut in some factory and the food's repackaged. So unless you're buying fresh produce, you may not quite know what you're getting unless you have these skills, unless you have these 5 clues at your disposal. And ultimately, this comes down to a yes or no choice. A nutrition detective is trained. Use these 5 clues to decide whether or not you're going to take a food or leave it behind. It's that simple. And the good news here in our modern food supply is that, yes, it has deficiencies, but it's very rich. There are excellent choices in every food category if you know how to find them. So the message here is not to give up foods you love, but rather in all of the categories of foods you love, identify and choose the foods that will love you back. That's what we teach the kids to do. One of the specific clues relates to finding whole grain. This is very important. There is a significant distinction between whole grain and refined grain, which leaves only part of the grain. These are the five clues, and I'll run through them with you quickly because you can start using them in the supermarket right now. You see how simple this is. This fits on a refrigerator magnet. One, we teach the kids don't trust what's on the front of the package. It's a commercial. May be true, may not be true, irrelevant. It's not what you need. Go to where the true information is, ingredient list, nutrition facts. Two, the first ingredient is the most abundant. So, for example, a breakfast cereal, if the first ingredient is sugar, that's not a cereal grain. That would be fine in the candy aisle, but that's like pouring milk over jelly beans in a bowl and calling it breakfast. That's just not the right thing to do. Three, look for hidden junk in food. We teach the kids about partially hydrogenated oil, artificial ingredients. If you find those things, step away from the box and nobody will get hurt. Four, avoid foods with a long ingredient list. In general, the foods closest to nature have the shortest ingredient list. For example, an apple, the ingredient is apple. You get the idea. So the more you approximate that, the better off you're doing. And then you just heard about the clue for grain products. Fiber is your friend. Look for 2 or more grams per serving. We send the kids home with doggy bags for their brains, telling them that they should chew on these things as they reflect on the program. What they eat really matters. Food can taste good and be good for you if you know how to choose those better options. You can eat better just by making better choices one food at a time. You don't have to give up categories of food you love. But you must be a good nutrition detective, a supermarket spy, to find those better foods. They should steer clear of added junk. And if they want a high-performance body, and I know we are all committed to cultivating the high-performance body, they must put in high-performance fuel. Through the generous support of Juice Plus and NSA and the support of my nonprofit foundation, Turn the Tide, like ABC for Fitness, Nutrition Detectives is available to everyone for free, including now this interactive DVD shot in this magical classroom, where the only cost to a school will be the cost of shipping the DVD to them. And so once again for that, I thank you. Let's finish up. We have a big job to do. There are a couple of ways we can get it done. They relate to levies and levers. I've already described the fact that each individual contribution we might make to a global effort to reverse the tide of obesity, diabetes, and related chronic disease is part of the solution. We should not expect too much from any one thing we do. We should do everything we can. On the other hand, if we take advantage of the opportunities to get into schools, we have the potential at times to apply a very powerful lever. Archimedes said, give me a lever long enough, I can move the whole world. We can potentially move the quality of everyone's diet and of the food supply and move people toward better health. As we think about this mission and wonder who should be involved, the best answer comes from Dr. Seuss. You're all familiar with Horton Hears a Who? You know what had to happen for the Who's not to get boiled in Beazle nut oil? Every last Who had to get involved. We are not at risk of being boiled in Beazle nut oil, but we are at risk of having our gooses cooked in partially hydrogenated oil and too much saturated fat. And to fix that problem, every one of us has a role to play. For the availability of the Nutrition Detectives program, my thanks to Juice Plus, to NSA, to all of you, and again, to the work on behalf of my nonprofit foundation to make this available. We are working hard to get the word out to schools so they can take advantage of these programs. I do a blog almost daily for Prevention Magazine. I can talk about things there. I write a weekly column for the New York Times Syndicate. And, of course, we're corresponding with healthcare professionals. But I would like you, like that last Who, to lend your voice to this chorus as well. There will be a shortened version of this DVD, which is in 5 chapters in about an hour, available for you as part of your marketing calls. You can introduce this to people. Now, it's of use even in the home. There's no reason why kids couldn't watch this at home. It's fun. But certainly, if you're talking to people with any connections to a school, please introduce this. So I'm hoping I can count on you. And information about the program, materials to teach the program are available as they have always been online. You can get people to all of the programs I've talked about on my website, davidkatzmd.com, but we now have a dedicated site, again, thanks to NSA, nutritiondetectives.com. And so you can help spread the word. We absolutely do face a big challenge, but it is so enormously gratifying to stand here and look out on a network. It's like a Verizon commercial, If we function collectively, if we together rally around the things that inspire our passion, everybody will hear us now. And we will pass that passion along. And when we are impassioned about a mission, nothing is too hard. We can move mountains. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and attention today.